Thank you, Teresa. Ladies and gentlemen, Teresa Eamon, we're proud to have her as part of our team for many, many years now. Thank you, Teresa. You're a wonderful singer, wonderful person. We have a lot of great volunteers as they all swarm out here to change the setting here to get ready for this beautiful Lysander we're going to feature a little later on. We have had some very unique airplanes, very unusual airplanes, new restorations. We've had a great lineup this year, and today is no exception. Warbirds in Review, by the way, I'm Connie Boland. I'm the founder and now the coordinator, but I don't do all the hard work. Kyle Guyatt right here does most of the detail hard work, and her husband Scott runs the production crew in the building behind me. And that building behind me was donated by Ron and Diane Fagan. They came a few years ago and said, you need somewhere where this great production crew can produce what you want to do. And we ended up with this building that we do have the production crew room, the green room, where we ready for the shows. So thank you to Ron and Diane Fagan. Scott's Miracle-Gro Company, Jim Hagedorn, is a great friend, great Warbird supporter, and a supporter of Warbirds in Review. This is all funded by sponsors, the donations that I receive, we receive to support this program, even down to the bleachers and the sound system. Just a little detail here. We in Warbirds in Review pay for all of this, and your support, your smiles, and the people that we recognize here is the reason we do this. And I'm very proud to say thank you to those two sponsors and the other sponsors that buy ads on our Jumbotron. But this outfit that I have on this morning, a special thanks to Jim Hagedorn, because I was able to fly his P-51 this morning for a couple of flights. Somebody needs to do it. Jim was not here today. He'll be back this afternoon, so I'll hand over the keys, although it doesn't have keys. But I'll give those back to Jim today. But this morning, I had the honor of flying a young man who is why we're here. History, heritage, and heroes. And I'm sure he would, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he would not consider himself a hero, but we do. Kyle Carpenter is the youngest Medal of Honor recipient. And he was in my back seat today, and he shared a video when we got back on the ground of us flying in the airplane. They have a picture of Kyle there. And can we show the video from my back seat this morning? We went over on the east side of the lake, and we all went in trail. There's another P-51 Mustang behind us there. We're all in trail doing rolls, and that's the coolest thing. That's going to be the highlight of my trip to Oshkosh. But is that so cool? So that's why we do this, and it's a real pleasure. So our thanks to Kyle, and Kyle is right here. He'll give you a wave. This is all totally impromptu, thank you, Kyle. It was an honor to have you in my back seat, and thank you for your service and all you have done. This is very special. Thank you very much. And thank you. So we'll have the Veterans Parade here tomorrow, where we gather all the services, and they depart from here to go down to Show Center. At that time, we'll have several Medal of Honor recipients here, including General Brady. So we look forward to seeing you again tomorrow, Kyle. Thank you. It was so fun for me to have you in my backseat. That was so cool. Thank you. All right, and now, ladies and gentlemen, on to the main event here. We have a video about the Lysander, and once that is completed, Sam Bass, our moderator for this program, will be out with our main event. So if you will direct your attention to the Jumbotron, and thanks for being here. Thank you.
Lysander is a strange airplane. Compared to the Spitfire or Mustang, it's a big aircraft with a wingspan of about 50 feet. It was designed for short takeoffs and landings from rough, unprepared airfields. Its role was to provide the British Army with reconnaissance, artillery spotting, and general communications capability. Nicknamed the Lizzie, the Lysander was produced by Westland Aircraft and used immediately before and during the Second World War. Like other British Army air cooperation aircraft, it was given the name of a military leader. In this case, the Spartan General Lysander. The first Lysanders entered service in June 1938. Four regular squadrons equipped with Lysanders accompanied the British Expeditionary Force to France in October 1939 and were joined by a further squadron early in 1940. Following the German invasion of France and the Low Countries on the 10th of May 1940, Lysanders were put into action as spotters and light bombers. In spite of occasional victories against German aircraft, they made very easy targets for the Luftwaffe, even when escorted by Hurricanes. Hundred and 118 Lysanders were lost in or over France and Belgium in May and June 1940, of a total of 175 deployed. With the fall of France, it was clear that the type was unsuitable for the coastal patrol and army cooperation role, being described by Air Marshal Arthur Barrett, Commander-in-Chief of the British Air Forces in France, as quite unsuited to the task. Once France was lost, the Westland Lysander was retasked with special duties and was used with great success, making clandestine flights into occupied territory at night on secret missions vital to the outcome of World War II to place or recover agents, particularly in occupied France with the help of the French resistance. The Lysander introduced STOL, short takeoff and landing capability crucial to today's military, long before the term was coined. As a flagship for spying missions behind the lines, it had no equal. A small lone aircraft winging through the night into enemy skies with little fanfare, except for perhaps diversionary missions by other aircraft in order to attract attention. This was stealth technology in the 1940s during World War II, and Westland Lysanders flown by the RAF were one of the original stealth aircraft. Restorer Mike Potter bought Lysander Charlie Foxtrot Victor Zulu Zulu from a Saskatchewan farm. Used briefly post-war as a crop duster, it had languished for decades until being largely restored by a Saskatchewan collection and warbird restorer, Harry Wariat, the man who also began the restoration on the Hawker Hurricane 12, joining us today. The Lysander is currently owned by John Carswell of Toronto, whose father, Andy Carswell, flew them with the RCAF. Pilot Dave Hatfield has said that flying a Lysander is truly a remarkable experience. One gets the feeling that with 20 hours or so in the airplane, you could do amazing things with it. Too bad they were never put on floats. Bush flying with a Lysander would be eye-opening.
All right, let's go. Good morning, folks. Thanks for coming. This is Dave Hatfield, And he is the pilot and the authority on this airplane, and he's very well qualified. He is the chief pilot of Vintage Wings of Canada. He comes from a large aviation family. He had, what, 8 flying at this time?
Yeah, 8 of us fly now.
His brother is Chris, and he was the first Canadian astronaut to walk in space. He's a retired Air Canada pilot. His Warbird qualifications are some of these. He's got a lot more. He's got a P-40, P-51, Spitfire, Hurricane, Lysander, and many others. Is that correct? Is that, yeah. He's also a musician, a songwriter, a sailor, and an author, and that's for another day. All right. Have a seat. Oh.
Thanks, Sam.
Dave, this is a, to say the least, a very unique airplane. And part of the history was covered up here in the Jumbotron. But would you kind of elaborate on the development of this airplane, why it was developed?
Sure. So this was designed in the middle 1930s when most air forces in the world, and particularly the Royal Air Force, were flying biplanes. And they wanted a battlefield observation and utility airplane to be in place for the next war. And so Westland took the unusual step of actually going to the pilots of the Royal Air Force and saying, what would you like in an airplane of that kind? And canvassed all the responses and put them together into the design of this airplane. And they wanted an airplane, the pilots wanted an airplane where they could see really well. And the visibility from that thing is superb. The pilot can adjust his seat so you're exactly at the wing level, so only a very small part of the view is blocked out. You can see above, you can see below. The windows come way down, so you're just a little bit of angle of bank, you have a perfect view. And of course, it's the same for the person in the back seat. So if you're taking up a general or something to show him the front lines, he could see everything very clearly. The other thing the pilots wanted was really good stall characteristics, short takeoff and landing, so that they could land very close to the battlefield. And they wanted the capability to land through ditches and mud and obstacles and rocks and all that sort of thing. And you can see the result, of course, in the design of this main landing gear. They wanted heat. They wanted a canopy, all those things you don't necessarily have in a biplane. They wanted an engine with a self-starter because, you know, those Hawker biplanes from the 1930s didn't have a starter in the Kestrel engines. They had a Model T type of a contraption that would spin up the propeller called a Huck starter. So all these things were put together by the Westland team, and they came up with this design. It looks a little unusual to our eyeball, but in 1935, it was innovation and cutting edge.
Well, how about the specifications on the airplane?
Specifications?
Yeah, about the engine range.
It's a big airplane, as you can see, a 50-foot wingspan. It's heavy, but you can make it maneuver. It's very light on the rudders, sort of normal in pitch for the range that you can actually control it in. And a little bit heavy in the ailerons, but you can make it move. You can make it cavort. Shall I talk about the flaps and slats?
Yes, go ahead.
The most unusual feature that they designed into the airplane. Hey, Xavier, would you come down here? This is one of our support team members, Xavier from Quebec and from Vintage Wings. If you wouldn't mind climbing up on that side, and he'll show you how the flaps and slats work. And this is really unique. Now, leading edge slats, the ones on the front of the wing, are in two sections. And, yeah, the hardest thing is not falling off that airplane, to be honest. I've been flying it around for 6-7 years now, and I haven't fallen off yet, and I'm really proud of that. But anyway,
pardon? If that wasn't you, we'd be calling an ambulance.
Yeah. So many airplanes have leading edge slats, and they're activated totally by the airflow. But in this airplane, they're linked to the flaps through some very clever gearing and chains and springs and that sort of thing. they're cross-controlled or cross-linked so that they can't be, go out asymmetrically and give you a roll, which you wouldn't want. They don't come out in any gradations. They just come out very smoothly. So as you decelerate, starting at about 105 miles an airplane, the way or miles an hour, the way this airplane is rigged, they start creeping out, and they're completely out by the time you flare and touch down at about 60. So it's very transparent as a pilot. You don't, you can't select them, you can't lock them in, can't lock them out, can't extend them, can't retract them. They're completely automatic. And that is some really interesting ramifications for when you're on approach.
Well, does it change your pitch attitude?
Yeah. Thanks, Xavier. So, yeah, as you change your pitch attitude, you change the lift vector, which influences where the slats and flaps go. So if you're, it has some strange characteristics. If you're on approach and you're just a little high, the tendency is to lower the nose. As soon as you do that, the angle of attack decreases, the flaps and slats come in, the airspeed shoots up, and you go way long. On the converse side, if you're a little bit short, you pull the nose up, angle of attack increases, they deploy to the maximum, the speed drops, you start this tremendous descent rate, and then if you goose the throttle, the Bristol Mercury has a really unusual accelerator pump. It's over-muscled, much bigger than it has to be in the carburetor, and you get what's called a rich cut. So the engine quits just when you're coming down like a ton of bricks. And there are lots of World War II pictures of these things plonked down under the ground 300 feet short of the runway with the wings draped over them. So it's unusual, this whole flaps and slats thing. Now, when you're just maneuvering, like over a battlefield, or as you saw in the video at an air show display, it's a piece of cake. It's great. It's wonderful. It's the original hands-on throttle and stick. You don't have to deploy anything. But in this landing environment, you can't move the nose up and down on approach. It just destabilizes everything. So what I tend to do, and of course this is just my own method, but on the downwind leg, I get the speed back to 80, so I have a good deployment of these. And I get the power back to a rate of descent that's probably going to get me at the touchdown point, you know, more or less. And then maybe I stay a little bit high, and then I try not to touch either power or speed, keep them constant. And I do a slipping turn onto final, and then side slip as required, just like it's a Stearman or a Waco, to get to adjust the touchdown point. And that's what I find works out for me. And generally, it's a three-point landing, and the airplane likes to do that. It does that better than a wheeler, and it tends to stay straight. So those are good characteristics, and that's what I worked out how to land the thing.
While you're talking about that, you mentioned to me yesterday that an average Warbird pilot that's got a lot of time in a T6 or something, they could normally just transfer into a B-51 or a B-47, but this airplane doesn't work that way. Is that correct?
That's right. So as Sam said, if you have a tail dragger background and you check out in a T6 and you've got those kinds of skills, and you walk up to a fighter, a Mustang or something, and someone tells you how to get the gear up and down, how to start it, how the fuel systems work, chances are you could get it around the patch and on the ground again without damaging it. But not this airplane. It's weird. In addition to that flaps and slat thing, the elevator is not powerful enough to control the airplane at either end of the envelope. So if you're coming down on final and you hit the trim in the middle, and then you pull the power to idle, to flare, you could pull the stick right back to your spine and it'll just go like this and arrow into the earth. Same thing if you're going around. If you had the trim in the middle and you went to go around power, the thing will go for the moon, even if you had the stick buried in the instrument panel. So that's not so great. The original test pilot from Westland in 1936, Harold Penrose, when he first took it up, you know, he was exploring the landing environment there before he came down and committed for landing, and he had trouble getting it into a landing attitude, and he had to do that with a combination of power and blowing air over the tail and getting the nose up and then just keeping that going till he plunked it down. And he suggested that they completely redesign the horizontal surfaces on the tail. But instead, Westland wanted to get the airplane operational, and so did the Royal Air Force, because it was a big PR effort, you know, the new airplane for the Royal Air Force. They wanted to get this into service. So they put the horizontal stabilizer on a jack screw, and that's the trim mechanism, kind of like a cub. And so you have to use it to control the airplane. You need the authority of the horizontal stabilizer to flare the airplane or go around. So this is a little different from a pilot's point of view, right? You, the way I do it is when I'm about 200 feet above the ground, I commit. I'm landing, period. I don't care what anybody says. I don't care if a truck comes out, I'll go around it. And at that point, I lock the stick, you know, with my hand, and then I start winding the trim, which is a horizontal stabilizer, back so that 15 seconds from now, I can pull the power back and I have the authority I need to flare. So that's a very different way of operating an airplane. So. You've got to think what you're going to need, the control regime you're going to need in 15 or 20 seconds.
Well, how did you figure that out the first time?
And I almost plunked it into the ground, right? And I went, whoa, that's not very good. I'm not doing that again. So I worked out with our chief pilot at the time, who was a very experienced test pilot, John Aitken. And he was a chief test pilot for the National Research Council of Canada. And we, you know, worked out a regime and a way to fly it for takeoff and landing that suits the airplane.
Well, tell us about the little guns up here on the spats.
So these spats are really interesting. They're not just decorations. They house a bunch of mechanisms. I can get up here, right?
Sure.
So this is where the 303 machine guns were, one on each side. And two screws, you can open up this and expose the breech mechanism of the gun and remove it. This was the belt feed down for it. So when they went to France in 1940, they had carried guns, and the guy in the back seat had a machine gun for defensive fire. So that was one option for that. The spats are hiding a shock absorber that's right built into the wheel hub. So not only do we have the flex of the whole arch of the gear leg, but you've got a shock absorber built right into these big wheels, too. So that really helps on the rough ground. And then these four, this plate could be removed, and then a little stub wing would come out, and they could hang small bombs off that, or a life raft. And they use this for search and rescue in the English Channel. And, you know, if there was a pilot floating down there with a life jacket, they could drop a raft, a safety raft, a rescue raft to him. So it had, it was a very flexible airplane. You could configure it for a lot of different jobs.
So that, what you, in the video up here, it said it was not successful as liaison, if you want to call it that. Could you extemporate on about it was not successful as far as liaison earlier?
Sure.
In the
sure.
War.
When they designed the airplane, they figured that the next war would be kind of like the last war, right? It would be a bit like World War One with trenches and fixed fighting lines, and so this would be great for taking a general up to see what's what. However, of course, nobody expected that the Germans would conquer France in 2 weeks in May of 1940, and that the battle was a battle of movement. So there wasn't really the role for this airplane, and it couldn't defend itself against the Messerschmitt 109s. It wasn't successful in that role. But it's such a flexible airplane that they were able to use it for many other jobs afterwards.
Well, and the clandestine, give us just a typical flight for a clandestine flight.
Yeah, so it was employed by the Special Operations Executive from 1942 to 1944. And this was one of Churchill's ideas and programs to support the French resistance, spies. In fact, there's a gentleman named on the side. I think you can see it on this side as well. Yeah, Cliff Stewart. His designation was W5, just like 007. He's a Canadian from the Maritimes who went in with Lysanders and back out again five different times, teaching the French resistance about dynamite and detonators and codes and ciphers and radios and all the stuff that they needed to function under the noses of the Gestapo. So this was the program, and they would land spies in France and then pick them up again later. So they operated in moonlight, about a week on either side of the full moon, and they would land in just a cow pasture in France that was suggested by the resistance. So these resistance fighters had already been to England. They'd been trained to select a field so the pilot wouldn't end up hitting trees or wires or end up in a ditch or something right. like that. So these fields were, you know, supposed to be good for the airplane and for the pilot. But they landed in the dark. And even though this airplane has tremendous landing lights on either side, and it's got a chute in the back for parachute flares, you know, the pilot can release a parachute flare and light up the whole world. They couldn't do that because that would tell the Gestapo where they were, right? So they landed on the light of three flashlights. So they'd have guys down there in the field shining flashlights up into the sky in an L formation. And the airplane would come in and land, you know, towards the leg of the L, plunk it down onto the ground, turn around in the direction of the L, back taxi. As they back taxied, whoever was on board would be bailing out of the airplane, and they had a ladder welded to the this side, the port side of the airplane, an external ladder. So people will be climbing down, and then other people will be climbing back in. And the pilot, of course, he just wanted to spend the smallest amount of time on the ground before, you know, a trap was sprung or the Germans would show up with a truckload of guns. So he'd taxi back, they'd swing around, wouldn't shut down the engine, and off they'd go again. And this was a very successful program. They didn't lose very many airplanes. There's a tremendous book about it called We Landed by Moonlight by the fellow who led that program, Hugh Verity, and it's a real eye-opener.
So as successful as a clandestine, but not as a liaison, I suppose, so you say. And now you mentioned about how it fly and the quirks, the history of this particular airplane.
Yeah, so this is a Canadian airplane built in Toronto by National Steel Car, where the Toronto Airport, Pearson Airport, is right now, right on the northeast corner of the field in a factory, same factory that later produced the Avro Aero, the jet. And 220 of these were made in Canada. This particular airframe never went overseas. It worked within the training system, the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan, and from 1942 till the end of the war. And it was used for a number of duties, including gunnery training. So there's a hatch under the center, kind of looks like bomb bay doors. And you could open that, a big reel would go down, like a big fishing reel. They could let out 1,000 feet of line with a drogue on the end, and then other aircraft would fly up alongside and practice shooting that. So they were training the gunners for the Lancasters and those other aircraft.
How about this particular paint job on this?
Yeah, so this particular airframe was not painted in these colors when it was in operational service. When it was towing the drogue, they made it as bright as possible, right? What they called the Oxidol paint job from the laundry detergent. It was yellow and black stripes all the way around the airplane. And that was so that the gunners would shoot the drogue, not the airplane. Whenever they got messed up and they got the bullets, the tracers and everything a little too close to the airplane, the pilot of the Lysander said, "Hey, we're pulling this thing, not pushing it." This one in its original service was in that stripe paint job, but there was already one flying with that paint job. So we decided to recreate the paint and the scheme, the color scheme of the very first one made in Canada, VIN number 416. And this is the way it came out of the factory. So,
well, the restoration to this airplane, it was in pretty bad shape when you got it, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah, so at the end of the war, you know, in Saskatchewan, where this became surplus, farmers just bought them because they couldn't otherwise get wires and switches and valves. They needed hardware, and there was a lot of useful hardware in these airplanes, Hurricanes, Lancasters, Blenheims, Bolingbrokes, all those kinds of airplanes. But this Harry Wariot, a pilot, collector, farmer in Saskatchewan, got three of them, and he was able to put them all together and so, yeah, they were all in rough shape. You know, they'd been stripped and parked out in fence rows and behind the barn and that sort of thing. But you can replace wires and switches. The basic structure was very intact. And this airplane is a very original airplane. It's the opposite of a data plate restoration. We have all kinds of, you know, most of the metal on this is original. All this stuff around the spats, I mean, that's not modern and made in a English wheel. That's all original. And, you know, these data plates, they were put there by the people in the factory there at National Steel in 1942. So when we got it, we stripped it and took it all apart and replaced some of the wood because it's a wooden structure. Let me just open this up for you. So as you can see, it's a steel tube structure, but then it's wood in there, and then a fabric cover, right? So, hey, Steve, I'll just pass you this so it doesn't fly away in this wind. And it's a unique airplane. It's light for its volume because of that. It's the combination of steel, wood, and fabric, and aluminum made it do its job very well. And
how long did it take you to do the restoration?
It was about 2 years. We just had to send the engine overseas. This is in terms of restoration, Steve, Terry, guys, stand up. We have some of the original restoration crew here, and they drove all the way from Ottawa to support the airplane. And Xavier, you stand up, and Robin, and, you know, the whole crew here. And then where's John? John and Jeff from Lysander Group. They're here taking pictures somewhere. There they are down there. Yeah, the people who've supporting the airplane now. So it was a big effort to, we had a big team. We had about, 15 guys working steadily every weekend under the management of someone who had already restored one for the Hamilton group. And, they did a great job. Sometimes it was woodworking school, sometimes it was fabric school, but everybody enjoyed the experience. Yeah. And, everything's working just fine here 12 years later.
Did you do just a little short walk around here? Not one of the big walk around, but a short walk around?
A walk around? Yeah,
and
sure.
Kind of show us what's going on.
Well, let's see.
Why don't you start the engine?
Start the engine?
Yeah.
It's a Bristol Mercury, and it's the only one flying in North America. This is the only Lysander flying in North America. It's 850 horsepower, so it's quite powerful. It's kind of like a Wright 1820 that's in a B-17. It's a geared engine. That's the geared assembling at the front there, that bullet. And it's supercharged. It's got a geared supercharger. So it's actually a very powerful engine for its frontal area. And this propeller is not constant speed. It's a de Havilland propeller, and it's either coarse or fine. So that's the only selection you have in the cockpit. The hardest part about it is getting up and down without falling off. I can't really demonstrate that in the... I'll do it for the cameras because they can get me on this, but I'm sorry the airplane's in the way. But, you know, I've learned over the years, I marked this first footstep with a piece of tape so I can find it, and there, and then I switch hands, and then I switch feet, and I grab it here, and I grab it there, switch feet again, other one goes in the stirrup, and then I'm up here ready to change the light bulbs for the airport light stands. So, it's a long way up. It really is. I don't know. To get here, I think I was up and down about 200 times on this flight so far. But the point of view, the field of view you have is great. The seat goes way up and down. And then if you're taxiing around after landing, you can actually unhook your straps and stand up in the seat practically, because it uses a hand brake, right? It's not toe brakes. It's a pivoting rudder bar down there. And you squeeze the hand brakes. They're pneumatic brakes. And, you know, they're drum brakes, pneumatically powered. And you can steer it while you can, while your head is up high and you can actually see where you're going. You can't do S turns in this like you can in a P-51. The tail wheel's free castering. You can't lock it straight. It's free castering, and the brakes don't work very well. So it's an interesting experience to taxi it around in these narrow taxiways. Initially, it was supposed to be operated out of a grass field, right? A big square 15-acre grass field, but you're always landing into wind. You don't really need brakes, and it works great in that role. But for flying around in modern airports, I have to consider that I can often land situations where I can't taxi. So it's like flying a ski plane or a float plane. You have to think in your head as a pilot, what are you going to do after you land? How am I going to get to, you know, where I have to go, the dock or the... Anyway, so... That's the first thing in the walk around. And the next is all these British fasteners. They tend to, all these things, they tend to vibrate loose. So as you go around with either a Zeus tool or you know, Swiss Army knife, which is what I use most of the time, and you're always finding some that are loose. These panels all come off in just a few seconds. You saw me demonstrate that. So you got to go around and make sure all the pins are pushed in hard. The airplane does shake a little bit, and you wouldn't want to lose one of these things. This is a most interesting, unusual. This thing here is the exhaust pipe collector. So the exhaust goes forward into the front of the cowl, and then it's collected and put out through this long pipe. This exciter tube goes down the center, can function as a cabin heat for winter if you want to do that. This made it very quiet during the special operations executive in France. You know, with the engine pulled back a little bit and all the exhaust going through this pipe, it was very quiet. You could fly over a village and no one would know you were there. After that, you go up, like we showed you earlier, make sure the flaps and slats are working well. Working evenly and smoothly. And it's kind of like a regular walk around after that.
Well, Dave, we really appreciate it. Thank you for bringing the airplane.
Oh, and, Sam, it's a pleasure. And I'd like to say, well, there's a particular gentleman who was mentioned in the film, John Carswell. His father was Andy Carswell, who was shot down in a Lancaster, World War II, wrote a great book called Over the Wire, and then he flew these after the war, right? So John was in the RCAF in the early 1980s and runs an investment company, but when this airplane was put up for sale, he thought it should not leave the country. So he went, he put, you know, his money where his mouth was. He stepped up and he bought the airplane. So Jonathan and Jeff... they're the representatives of John Carswell. John couldn't make it. He's got a wedding to go to and some other concerns right now. But there's Jeff. Where's Jonathan?
Oh, anyway, these sons.
Anyway, they support the owner, and we really appreciate John for making this all happen and sending us out, even though he wasn't going to be able to join us.
Yeah. You know? Okay. How many veterans do we have? Please stand up. Let's recognize the veterans here.
Veterans.
And we have some time now for questions, if anybody has any questions. We've got people with mics here. If you just raise your hand.
This one. Oh, yeah, I need a microphone. Good.
Yeah.
I'm just curious. Hello. I'm just curious, you said this was the only one in North America. Any idea how many are flying worldwide? How many are left flying?
There are two flying in the UK. one at Duxford, and I believe you can go for a ride in that if you want, and then one at the Shuttleworth Collection in the UK. There's one being restored by Sabina in Belgium, but I don't know what stage it's at. There are quite a few in museums, but I'm just talking about flying airplanes.
Over here.
You mentioned that's the only British Mercury in North America, and I think you were going to go into it earlier as far as who did the engine work. You had to send it overseas. Could you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, this engine is made out of unobtainium now. I mean, we didn't want to come here without a spare cylinder in a box in case we blew a jug, right? Could not find one. So it is a rare experience to fly a Bristol Mercury, and it's not going to last forever, you know. There are spares, but there are so few now that everyone who has them is hoarding them, just like I would. You can't blame them. And to find us parts is really difficult. So, yeah, this was restored by John Romaine's outfit, ARC, at Duxford. This engine was overhauled, was zero-timed in about 2008. And it only has about 100 hours on it. And I suspect it'll go 400 or 500 hours at the power settings that I'm using. So I think we still have time on it. And who knows? That'll be a number of years before we have to overhaul it again, I hope. Let me see. Where's wood? Yeah. And maybe there will be more parts available by then. I sure hope so.
Can you speak about pilot training, and can it be flown from the back seat?
I'm sorry.
Can you speak about pilot training for their aircraft, and can it be flown from the back seat?
Yeah, well, pilot training in this is a big conundrum, right? Because it flies differently from everything else. And in the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan, just like here in the States, generally the pilot maker was the T6, the Harvard, right? But it's not really good preparation for this, and that's why there are lots of pictures of crashed Lysanders by the side of the runway from that period. So what I found most useful is to get into the British frame of mind. British airplanes are different from North American airplanes. Not better, not worse, but different. You know, you look at the turn and bank instrument, which is a great big thing. It's got two pointers on it, and the top one's the ball, not the bottom one, right? You got to get used to little things like that. You got to get used to a no-brake kind of an airplane. So if you've ever flown a Moth that has, it's a British one, that has no brakes and just a tail skid, that's good trainer. You have to do the research and get the briefings and understand the foibles of this airplane before you fly it. But it's handy if you've been flying oddball types where you don't have good brakes and you don't have good steering.
Crosswind landings.
Sorry?
Crosswind landings.
Crosswind landing. It's actually not bad in a crosswind. The rudder is quite effective, and you generally just two-point it, like a, you know, side slip, and a three-point landing, except you're touching down on the upwind main and on the tail wheel. You can wheel land it, but there's a lot of bounce in this structure. It's kind of like landing a Citabria. You know, any energy you feed into it is coming right back at you, and you get thrown back up into the air. It tends to track pretty straight. So I'm comfortable on a cross-country with a 10-knot crosswind. I could probably do a little more, but I'd rather not.
What's, you know, speed?
Well, I come in at 80, but you're going to touch down at about 60. Yeah, miles an hour. Yeah. I'd be touching down at about 60, 65. And but it's funny, these brakes are never the same. Like, always one brake's a little better than the other. So sometimes if the wind's between two runways, you'll pick the one where if you have to use brake to stay straight, you got the better brake. Right? So again, you're thinking about what you're going to do after you touch down, before you commit to it. And there are times you can land this airplane and you can't taxi it. So, you know, if it's a strong wind, you can land directly into it, and that's great, but you have a heck of a time doing a 180, right? And I often take somebody like Xavier in the back seat so he can jump out, put his shoulder to the back of the airplane, turn it around so I'm on the vector I want, and then he pops back in and we taxi towards the ramp. It's an awkward thing, you know, on a windy day. Yeah, here at Oshkosh, I get towed out to the runway or very close to it.
Yes, sir.
The Mercury's a sleeve valve engine?
No, Bristol made both, right? And the Lysander 2 had a Perseus, which was a sleeve valve. This is a Lysander 3, and these are poppet valve engines with the Bristol Mercury. There's four valves on each cylinder, like two exhaust, two intake, and they're exposed valve stems, which is actually pretty handy if you're trying to diagnose whether or not you got a stuck valve, and I was in that situation coming out here. These cowlings come off quite simply. They take a couple of people because they're big and clumsy, but just a couple of diaper pins and big over-center hooks, and then boom, you got one off, boom, you got the other off, and then you got all nine cylinders exposed, and then, you know, you can close the valve and just put a wooden handle on the end of the stem and push it and make sure it's not stuck. Very simple and very good. I like that aspect of the design. They did operate some in Canada with the sleeve valve engine, the Perseus, but they're hard to operate in the cold of a Canadian winter because the sleeves tend to gum up and hard to keep them warm enough to run.
Are you going to fly it in the show?
I hope so. I think today's a jet day, right? Yep, yeah. Besides which, I'm not at the briefing. But we'll see about tomorrow. I'd like to fly it very much in the show. But as I say, it depends on the wind. And a day like this, I'd be reluctant to do it.
Right. There was a second one in Canada that was yellow and black, and you mentioned this was the only flying one. What happened to it?
Well, it suffered an engine failure. Yeah, I was flying this one around that year, and the pilot's here on the grounds. I don't know. Rick, are you in the stands? Okay, he's a judge here, so he's probably doing some of that kind of work today. And he said it went from smooth, calm, lovely day to crunch. And prop stopped in about 5 seconds as the engine ate itself inside. So then he had to dead stick it in. And
salvage the airframe?
He didn't have the best choices. He was in an area with a lot of power lines and windmills. So he got down fine, and both himself and the passenger were 100%, you know, fine, no problem. But one of these gave way. So they haven't restored the airplane yet. I mean, it's all very doable, but it's just a question. You know, museums have priorities about what they're going to. So if there's a donor who wants to sponsor that restoration in the audience, you know, there's an opportunity there.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, a question. Would you ever consider modifying anything for, like, the brakes, to, you know, re-engineering anything? Or for the turning, with maybe putting some...
This airplane that was just asked about, the one from Hamilton, they put hydraulic brakes on it, and it was just as bad. It's something to do with the something to do with the architecture of this whole.
Did they put tow brakes on it also, or just it's still the handle?
I think they still use the handle, if I remember right, but they put basically the brakes off a Cessna 310 on it, I believe.
Yeah, okay.
And it didn't really help. Someone asked about the back. Just operating the canopy, the person in the back seat can open and close the canopy very easily, and you can do it at any speed. There's no limitation.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
When it was flown into an occupied country, how many people could they get in it?
Well, with 850 horse and these big wings, you can carry anything you can get inside it. So it's kind of volume limited rather than weight limited. So if someone was running away from the Germans and this was their only way out, they didn't care about comfort, right? And so there was one case that actually put five people in the back seat. Right now we just have one. They just cram people in.
Yes, sir.
That exhaust cowling is beautifully done. I'm wondering how unique it is to this aircraft, or had it been incorporated in other designs?
I had never seen it incorporated in any other designs. It's not a great idea to have the hot part at the front of the engine, right? Because it overheats on landing. It overheats on the ground. Because you got a big hot thing at the front warming up air that's then going through the cylinders. When I landed here, I had to shut down in the grass out there, just pull the plug, because I didn't want the cylinders to overheat and crack, you know, while I was here. So I mean, it's beautiful and it's shapely and, you know, it's very streamlined and all that. But sooner or later, you know, exhaust gases are going to corrode this. There's no way around that. And frankly, I wouldn't recommend that as a design, but that's what we have to live with, right? That's the way they did it.
Anyone else?
I would just say something else, Sam.
Yeah, go ahead.
A lot of people link this up in kind of the same category as the Fiesler Storch, and that's not really correct. The Storch is supreme at Stoll, but it can only go slow. One thing about this is you can fly it at 200 miles an hour if you want. You know, if you actually put the throttle up, it's very streamlined. I encourage you to walk in front of it later and look down. It's a very streamlined airplane. And if you tried to do 200 miles an hour in a Storch, you know, you just rip the wings off.
What's the range on the airplane?
It's got a 95 imperial gallon tank, and it burns just under 30 imperial gallons an hour at the power settings I'm using. So it's about 3 hours to a dry tank. So after about 2 hours, I'm looking for a place to land.
How long were the missions over
missions
there?
Missions were much longer. So they had an external tank underneath that looked like a torpedo, and it had fuel in that. So they also had to put a bigger oil tank in it for those five. It would be 2.5 hours into France, 2.5 hours back.
What does the oil burn on this normal?
Well, it depends on the temperature. It's like an 1820 in a B-17 in many ways, right? So. You know, 2 to 4 quarts an hour is not unusual. Right. It's pretty standard. And a lot of it gets pushed out. And then you're looking for volunteers to help you clean the belly of the airplane after you land.
Okay. Anyone else? Well, David, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Sam. We really appreciate that. That's very unique.
But we're not done yet. This is Sam's birthday. Okay, this is Sam's birthday. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Sam. Happy birthday to you.
A real professional singer, too. By the way, if you guys want to hear him sing, go on the YouTube and look up Dave Hatfield and look up, what is it, My Canada?
One of them's called In
that's,
Canada.
That's a good one. That's
in
good.
Canada.
And it'll refer you to others. And it's he and his brother, the astronaut, are singing, and they're very good.
We have a lot of fun. Anyway,
thank you.
Have a great time at Oshkosh.